Welcome to tonight's episode of the Remso Martinez Experience. Before we get started, I want to go ahead and give a shout out to some of this episode's sponsors. From self-publishing to podcasting and passive income development, I offer ongoing self-development courses at Champion Pundit Academy, as well as one-on-one private consultations to take you from zero to hero in no time. Learn more at championpunditacademy.com. That's championpunditacademy.com. You want to know what you need more of in your life? Politics. Yeah, nobody ever said that. But if you've got to go ahead and spend money on one nonfiction book, it's got to be the ultimate clash of wisdom, awesomeness, and then obviously the politics. But why not a little bit of comedy? Why not a little bit of a memoir? Why not something that's going to make you say, hey, I actually enjoyed reading this. I laughed. I learned something in the process. Check out my book. It's an Amazon bestseller. You may have heard of it. It's Stay Away from the Libertarians. It talks about all the things you think you might know about libertarians, plus a lot of things that I bet dollars to donuts you don't know about. You can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. So go on right now. You can get it in print or ebook or Kindle or whatever you call it. Just go out and get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble online today. It's Stay Away from the Libertarians by Remso W. Martinez. Happens to be me.
Hey, I'm Matt Conroy, country Americana songwriter and recording artist, and you're listening to the Remso Martinez Experience.
Folks, welcome back. This is the Remso Martinez Experience. Glad to have all of you back with us. If you're a new listener, welcome. This is a show where we talk about the impractical things happening in an improbable world. I'm your host, as always, Remso W. Martinez. Go ahead and follow me on Instagram at Remso, the number 4, VA, and on Twitter at Remso 4, F-O-R, VA, Remso 4, VA. This episode that we're going to go ahead and jump right into is about something that maybe about a year ago, if you remember, I was really trying to spend a lot of time focusing on, but I kind of dropped it for a little while. And while we're getting into a new year, but you know, the Fed is changing up interest rates, China is banning Bitcoin processors, Venezuela is still using Litecoin to pay for soap. We're entering a bit of a strange age, and a lot of you listening are probably within that millennial age gap between, I want to say, 17 to 30. So you're trying to find ways to make money, because if you're like many people I know, you're probably kind of drowning in a little bit of debt. You don't really feel comfortable with investing, and you see things like Bitcoin, and you think, well, I know a guy somewhere that made a lot of money off of it, so maybe I should go ahead and invest in Bitcoin instead of putting more in my savings or getting another job. I had somebody ask me recently, you think I should buy $500 worth of Bitcoin? And I said, why are you asking me this? This is not this. I get stupid PTSD from this. I call it stupid person PTSD, because when I hear questions like that, it's like that's the wrong way to think about it. But I want to go ahead and cover this, but I brought on somebody today that has a bit more of an understanding of, you know, how the economics behind trade and commodities actually work. He's the host of the Gold Standard, Alan Mosley. Alan, thank you so much for coming on, man. It's great to have you here.
Remso, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what do you say to my deluded friend that thinks that he's going to spend $500 on Bitcoin just for the hell of it?
Well, you know, right off the bat, I was listening to your intro just now, and I understand the frustration with it, because it's different, but it's not, right? Like Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in general is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, historically speaking, it's 1 second old. So there's still a lot yet to be seen from the crypto world. But to your friend's question of, hey, I'm thinking about dropping 500 on Bitcoin, what do you think I should do? You know, any investment expert would tell you, take the word Bitcoin out of that sentence. I'm going to drop 500 on any investment. Should I do it? The easy answer is you should only invest in things that you know. right? So if you're not somebody who is, and you don't have to look, you don't have to have an MBA or a PhD in econ or that sort of thing. But if you don't have a fairly well-read understanding of crypto markets and the volatility therein, then that's just a non-starter, right? Like, where do you even answer that question? You could replace Bitcoin with any other commodity or mean of exchange, and my answer would still be, I would rather you invest in things you know.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think everything comes down to the why. Why do you want to do it? Because a lot of people that I know that were jumping on the Bitcoin train post 2018, when, I mean, the Ethereum, Litecoin, all these other cryptos were selling for just crazy amount of money. Anyone mm-hmm. looking at that can say, okay, this is going to drop really fast because it's a speculator's market, and you have a lot of people buying into this that don't really know what it is, but they think they're going to get rich quick. So you have a lot of people that are really in two camps. You have the people that think that's just another, you know, way to invest, like their 401k, for example. I have a friend who himself and his father have both invested their 401ks in Bitcoin. I mean, they must have some crazy faith that I don't have, but that was their decision. And then you have other people that take less of the monetary, you know, stance on it, and they do it for more of what I would consider a philosophical stance. They really want to step away from the private bank-controlled fiat currencies of the world, and they want a true, authentic, you know, version of digital cash, a true competing currency. And when I got into Bitcoin and all these other cryptos that I jumped into, Dash, Litecoin, Ethereum Classic, like I'm not going to say I'm a financial expert on this, folks, because let me tell you this, I've lost more money than I care to admit. But I kind of knew that going in. And my goal initially was to try and use crypto as much as I could in my day-to-day life. And for a few months, I really did try. I was getting paid for, you know, some freelance work in crypto. I would try and get my waiters at local restaurants, much to their chagrin, to accept tips in Litecoin and Bitcoin Cash. So, like, I tried, because what I wanted to do was I wanted to show people this can work as peer-to-peer digital cash. And I don't necessarily think it's reaching anything higher than it was previously. I think blockchain technology as a whole is escalating and advancing the conversation, but I don't think the idea that we're going to be working in a crypto-based world where we have this peer-to-peer digital cash is any closer today than it was maybe a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, because, like with a lot of things, a lot of different aspects of this are linked. So when you talk about kind of the difficulties with the volatility of the market and the bubble from the previous year, not this past Christmas, the Christmas before, thereabouts, and then the bubble bursting, and kind of, you know, it's hindsight's 2020, right? So we can look back at that and say, boy, that was an obvious bubble. We kind of knew where this was going, but a lot of people were on the train. And I actually have a funny story about that. A lot of people don't know this about me, but a few years ago, I got into some sports gambling. I'm a big football fan. I actually have written some articles about this and cover this on a separate program. But I only bet regular season college and NFL football. I don't bet anything else. And again, it's because I only bet things that I know a lot about. And this was, on a side, I won't get into the particulars so that, you know, the IRS won't track me down, but I was getting a lot of
my funds. Oh,
they're
already going through your accounts right now.
Yeah, they're going right now, right? And I was getting a lot of my payments in Bitcoin because it was convenient for me to do it that way. And so I all of a sudden found myself with this chunk of Bitcoin, and that actually coincided around the same time as the bubble was blowing up. And so, of course, when you're in that seat, it's kind of play money, right? You're like, well, sure, why not? I'll just, you know, see where it goes. And I was one of the lucky ones that kind of got out of it right before the bubble burst, because I was in the same camp as you were, where it was like, this is, you know, you've heard, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. However, with that said, it's the bubble burst, but it's not like it was a miraculous thing, right? There's reasons why crypto has taken a hit over the last year. You know, you had mentioned China and Venezuela and things like that, and those aren't just passing little concerns, right? Like, when you talk about just some of the volatility in 2018, of course, we know the situation in Venezuela and how you have people down there that are turning to cryptocurrency as a means of survival. And my, you know, my thoughts are with those folks. I understand it's a hard time, but you think of authoritarian type regimes. You think of China sending their, you know, they were talking about, what was it back in around February or March? They were talking about banning cryptocurrency. Facebook was preventing ICOs from advertising on the social media platform. And, you know, and those types of decisions, you know, around the crypto market caused it to take several hits. And so was it a bubble? Yes, but I think it collapsed much more greatly. And I think that's because from if you're kind of turning the conversation more to the philosophical angle, I love the philosophical idea of having, you know, that decentralized monetary platform. However, we would be naive to think that the powers that be that have had a monopoly on currency for, you know, I don't know, a couple thousand years, we would be naive to think that there wasn't going to be some pushback, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the laws of basic economics, I mean, they're not, it's not like Bitcoin and all these other cryptos were deflecting them. Like, I use the example of fidget spinners of a lot of this stuff because, you know, I think at a fourth grade level at the end of the day. And I remember, you know, the fidget spinner fad that was going around back in late – in I think around mid-2017. And I'm not going to lie, like, you know, I'm not a rich person, but I bought a $12 fidget spinner. And looking back, like, I feel like a real dumbass because how much do fidget spinners sell for? You can get them – you can get like 100 of those things for a buck. It's really ridiculous. But everything at the end of the day comes down to, you know, what are people willing to pay for them? It's not like there was a scarcity of that. There's the scarcity effect of Bitcoin because Bitcoin and a lot of other cryptos – unlike certain, you know, token coins, you know, they do run off scarcity because only a limited amount has been produced. So that way they treat it like, you know, like they would treat anything tangible material, gold, silver, copper, etc. But, you know, this just goes down to the fact that a lot of people just were willing to not do a lot of homework and they were jumping into things like any other fad or craze, especially when it comes to this idea that you can get rich quick overnight. And I actually have this photo on my Instagram, folks. Go ahead and follow me on Instagram at Remso4VA, the number 4 and then VA. And if you go down to a post I made on December 29th, I was actually watching a couple videos about Dash predictions for 2019. And this banner came up that shows this cat sitting on a guy's lap typing at a keyboard. And right now it says pets now mining crypto. Get this new mining kit that now has pets being used to generate money for their owners. And for the love of Christ, I don't understand how a sane freaking person can look at that and say, yeah, that totally makes sense. Time to get the cat to work for us. Like, what absolute dumbass looks at that and then clicks on it? Now, I like, you know, I am a sucker for clickbait. Sometimes I click on it just to see how far the tunnel goes, just to kind of follow that rabbit through the rabbit hole to the other end of, you know, Wonderland. But in this case, I saw that, and, you know, these are the type of things that, like, the FEC was, you know, complaining about. And they were saying, you know, a lot of these ICOs and everything else, they're going to start getting to the point where when do they become scams? And then they were saying, oh, a lot of these new coins, initial coin offerings, are just scams. And it's like, what – especially in the finance world, when haven't people tried to scam other people? You can turn on the radio and I bet you're going to hear a couple financial scams. How much of this is just people really being taken advantage of, and how much of it is just – people not doing their due diligence to actually look into things?
Well, you know, if you look at it from kind of a socio-political or a cultural standpoint, you know, definitely in the Liberty community, there's people who want crypto to change the world. And I understand why. If you're an anti-Fed believer, you know, like, and I am, and if you're the type of person who believes that, well, we have to strike at the root, and the root of all evil is the central bank, then you're desperately wanting alternatives. You know, that there's the old phrase, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And so if you feel that we have a necessity to decentralize monetarily, then crypto just seems to be like the obvious answer. And that's not necessarily a modern trend, right? Like, you can, believe it or not, you can go on YouTube and there's a interview from back in the 70s with Friedrich Hayek, when he was, obviously he was a very old man, and I can send you the link. The interview is actually on YouTube, where one of the questions they're talking about is talking about monetary policy and, you know, the state monopoly of the money supply and how that needs to be broken in order to achieve a more free society. And so Hayek himself, and so you're talking like way ahead of the crypto world, back in, I think it was something like 1977, Hayek said, the result has been 2,000 years we've had a monopoly that nobody's questioned on monetary supply. So if we want to maintain a free society, we have to take the money monopoly from the government. So it's not a new concept. The problem with that is that, of course, it kind of piggybacking on what you've kind of implied, is that when you're thinking that much with your heart and not with your head, it's rife for abuse. And I certainly, you know, I'm not looking to the federal government or the state or, you know, whatever terminology you want to use. I'm not looking to them or their bureaucracies to tell me what is and isn't a scam. I would rather the market work and people make their own decisions. I'm certainly not trusting, you know, the FTC or anything else. With that said, of course there is going to be abuse. Of course there are going to be scams. It ties right back into the very beginning of this conversation, that how can anybody click on any of those links? How can anyone say, I'm going to take next week's paycheck and put it on X or Y without having done as much research as you would do, what, a piece of land or a new stock or whatever?
Yeah, like, and I mean, the whole let your pet buying Bitcoin for you type of thing. Like, I'm the type of person that thinks that, you know, bankruptcy is healthy for a society, especially for an economy. But like, this is survival of the fittest stuff. Like, if you lost your money, if you clicked on that banner, and I'm gonna get the one email from somebody that actually did see the same banner on YouTube, and they're like, yeah, my dog was just lazy though, and all the other bullshit. Like, I don't understand how much excuses we have to give for people. And this just goes for everything else, but, you know, kind of switching on this, I mean, just the application itself, I live in a pretty metropolitan area in the Washington, D.C. beltway, and we have some stores that actually do accept crypto, primarily Ethereum and Bitcoin Cash as well. I mean, there's a Bitcoin ATM in my neighborhood, so I don't want to downsize it and make it look like, you know, it's just completely halted in terms of like the knowledge of crypto. At least Bitcoin is a household name now, whereas a year and a half ago, that was not the case primarily. Mm-hmm. My biggest thing is I want to see it applied, but I don't think even us as a Western developed nation, we're just not interested in that. And like you said, with the Federal Reserve, I think everything kind of runs on a trust factor. We know that our money is inflating. We know that we're going to hit a state of hyperinflation within our lifetime, sadly. We know that the Fed prints money out of thin air, but 99.9% of our population is playing cognitive dissonance with this. It's like they know the problem is there, but we'll cross that bridge when we get there. So my question is this, and, you know, take your time with it, but do you think we have to reach like Venezuelan levels of monetary destruction to really start implementing these ideas in everyday life? Or do you think, you know, maybe we don't have to feel that much pain before I can go to Olive Garden or something and say, I'm just going to pay for this meal in Litecoin or something else?
I don't think we have to reach that level, but I'll add it with the caveat of we have to be careful with that word "we," because I think just like with any situation, there's always going to be haves and have-nots. And I think if the – now, as far as just kind of a brief economic outlook, I
talk
to
me
believe,
like I'm stupid.
No, okay. Well, I'll say this. So for people
small words.
So for people who can remember, you know, the financial crisis of 2008 and you know, the housing bubble and – I'm 33 years old, and I had actually bought my first house right after the housing bubble burst. My first house was a foreclosure in Middle Tennessee that I bought from a mortgage company for like $32,000 that before the bubble had burst, it at one point was valued at like 98.
Oh, that's I mean, it was a seller's market back then.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, just insane difference. And I felt
I'm
so
sorry,
bad
buyer's for market,
my,
buyer's market.
Yeah. My buyer's market. Yeah. And I felt so bad for my next door neighbor because he had done the opposite. He was a little bit older than me, but a relatively young guy. And he had bought his house next door to mine for I think it was 88, and he ended up walking away from it, and it was taken over. And they put a for sale sign in the yard, and it was, and they were trying to sell it for like 45. I mean, it's just and you hate to see those things happen to people, and so you know I certainly wouldn't want to advise anyone to that kind of end. Of course, you know, all predictions wrong or your money back when it comes to Alan Mosley and the gold standard. But with that said, I definitely think that we're in for the next big recession by the end of 2019. I really think we
really?
Are. I do. And
yeah,
I have,
that's way sooner than I would have pinned it. Why do you think that?
You know, part of it is hunch. Part of it is kind of contrasting it with the political cycle. I think if the economy were still humming at relative, of course, I mean, when I say humming, of course, I mean humming with tons of debt. But if it's relatively humming, you know, come this time about 6 or 8 months from now, I think there's a strong likelihood that you'll see a second term for President Trump. But I think there's a good chance that won't happen because I think we're within a year of the next big crash, and I think that there's a good chance that it's going to be worse than 2008. Now, to tie that back into our conversation about crypto, though, it's hard to say where that swings to pendulum, right? Because there's some people who would say that, you know, as the economy goes, as investment goes, and if you look at Bitcoin as an investment, then it'll go the same way. There's a lot of other people, I know you'll see this on CCN.com, it's crypto news, that would make the argument that the stock market and crypto are not inherently connected, and that if anything, you might see a lot more going into crypto markets when the economy tanks, as opposed to when the economy's good and people aren't looking for those alternative or those get rich quick schemes or whatever. Which I know that's a funny way of putting it, because that kind of implies that, well, you're just building another bubble, right? Because you're just having a chunk more uneducated people making desperate decisions. And there's some truth to that too.
Yeah, but that is also a very good thing. Like, you know, to an extent, I remember watching commercials back in, you know, 2007, right before the housing bubble popped. And I remember a lot of investors were telling people to jump into gold and silver. And for the people sure. that hedged a good amount of their investments in gold and silver, you know, like I have a friend, he did that with part of his life savings. You know, he lost about 30 grand, you know, when the banks were bailed out and everything else. But because he had played it smart, he ended up making three times as much money as he had prior. Now, he's mm-hmm. a very outlier case. Obviously, not a lot of people did that. But for those that did, that made sense. And I think people are making the same case for crypto. That's initially why I started looking into it, because, you know, I remember how the recession hit my family. We owned two homes at the time, you know, lost my college money and everything. So you know, I have kind of like that Great Depression syndrome where, you know, you've got a great grandma that wants to go ahead and shove all the money in the couch because she doesn't trust the banks and the FDIC and stuff. So I do totally get that. But, you know, I think the biggest thing that we've been hitting on, and this is where I'd like to kind of, you know, pivot a little bit, is, you know, financial literacy. You know, I don't claim to be the most financially literate person. I'm still trying to figure out how to handle my own life. But, you know, one thing that I really discovered was, you know, one thing I've tried to implement in my life is self-education, which I've, you know, I think I'm a bit better than most people around the block in my neighborhood. But, you know, another thing I've tried to do is understand the concept of passive income, so that when you don't have a job or when you get a pay decrease or something, you still have passive income revenue coming in. So like right now, for example, I'm working on my real estate license. Why, some people ask? Well, because I'm in a you know, what some people call a recession-proof housing market. I'm in Fairfax County. Fairfax County homes, for example, within the Beltway, actually did not see a significant decrease in home value. And we have one of the largest turnover rates for immigration and emigration in the country. So if I were to choose any place to be a real estate agent, you know, maybe people make the case for like Dallas and Houston, Texas, but I think, you know, up here in Virginia, because I'm so close to the swamp, I'm in a good position. But I don't think many people think that. That's what bothers me about the initial question that we started off with the show with. Should my friend spend $500 on Bitcoin? He doesn't understand why. He doesn't know why. And I don't, and it also jumps on the whole Venezuela thing. It's like how much do people have to hurt until they start to figure things out? So when the next let's assume that you're correct and the next recession hits in 2019, do you think that? And obviously, I'm going to pull the we question in this, but you know, bear with me a bit.
Sure.
Do you think that we have learned our lessons from 2008?
No, we definitely have not. I mean, if we're gonna stick with we, the financial literacy of we is probably at all time lows. Now keep in mind you're talking to Alan, the biggest cynic of all time, Mosley. So I don't have a lot of. A lot of hope for the future when it comes to
you should have bought gold, folks.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and not even going into things like gold and or any particular investment. A good friend of mine, I won't say his name on the air because he would probably get fired. He works for a major bank and certainly doesn't want to be tied into a crowd like me.
No, he won't just get fired. He'll get killed at that point. I saw that movie, The International. I know what the banks do.
Yeah, exactly. That is him. He's that kind of accountant. Yeah, he's the accountant with a sniper rifle. But you know, he's the kind of person that I sometimes will get a little bit of advice of, hey, my friend, I'm gonna cover this topic or that topic. What would be just the mainstream financial advice for X or Y? And one of the things he always comes back to is that. Despite volatility in the markets, and that's whether it's just Wall Street or whether it's crypto markets, despite you know bubbles in land or housing, national debt, whatever you have, the dollar has not collapsed. You know, if you're one of these borderline conspiracy types that's just you know waiting by with bated breath for the U.S. dollar to collapse or no longer be the world's reserve currency, and I'm not saying that that's not possible, but we're not there today, and I don't think we would even be there in another major recession this year.
I would say that you know just to kind of pause real fast. I would say that the odds of the dollar not being like the solid monetary standard for the world, I think the likelihood of that happening is more likely than, you know, a big dip in recession in 2019, because I mean those conversations have been happening and they're moving closer every day. Like, you know, with OPEC, they're thinking about the petrol dollar. And we have countries like Japan and Australia and India and the Philippines that are actually, you know, talking to China and they're like, yeah, why don't we just form petrodollar with the Saudis and everything else? Like I think, you know, just on a side note, I think that's more likely to happen sooner than, you know, a recession within the next year, just based off those conversations and the trends of what we're seeing. But, you know, trends lie, and I'm usually not the best person to get monetary and financial advice from.
Well, I mean, you know, again, I'm not saying that that's not a possibility.
It's all in the realm of possibility. At this point.
Exactly. But I tend to kind of have a wait and see approach as it pertains to those sorts of things. I mean, I'm the type of cynic that would think that, you know, the same powers that be that aren't just going to sit by and watch cryptocurrency change the world are the same powers that be that aren't going to just stand by and watch the global markets, you know, turn their back on the U.S. dollar. But with that said, the reason why I brought up my banker friend is that he deals with customers who are, you know, he's a loan processor. And so he's looking at the assets and financial statements of people at various different points in their life. And some of these people are very wealthy. I'll give you one perfect example. He had a customer who had at one point in time had a relative die and his inheritance was $10 million. Now, we'll just say for argument's sake, that was $10 million after taxes. So he's got $10 million in cash sitting in the bank.
That's a lucky dead relative.
Yeah.
Right there.
We're talking about folks who don't do a libertarian podcast. and, and, uh, And this guy was taking out a loan. I swear to God, this guy was taking out a loan because he wanted to remodel his kitchen. But he needed to take out a loan because the lion's share of that $10 million in cash that they had was gone. They had blown through it. Yeah, and the reason I bring that up is that you take that guy as an example. That guy could have put that whole $10 million in like a 2% CD or something similar. And if you could live on 200 grand a year, you'd never run out, right? Like, I mean, you would have that investment, you know, ad infinitum. But
at that point, your money's making money for you.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point is that, I mean, if you could live on a couple hundred thousand, you're set for life, and the $10 million would be there for your children and their children's children on and on and on. And so the point being is that when you're circling back to, well, my friend is thinking about dropping X amount of money and we're, you know, of course we're talking about smaller amounts of investments, like, hey, I'm going to put $500 in it. I will say this. I believe in cryptocurrency. I don't think that cryptocurrency is going to go away. I think that despite pushback and despite the bubble and despite volatility in 2018, I think the best is still yet to come for crypto in general. However, I put that with the caveat of, if it were my life and I had a very finite amount of resource with which to work, I would probably still be holding on to my cash, and I would probably still be putting it into property or precious metals over crypto today. And I say that as someone who believes in crypto, but today, if you were to ask me, Alan, what is your outlook for right now? That's where I'm at.
I would definitely agree. And I mean, there are a lot of people that I'm big on continually investing in one person, individual capital, your ability to learn trades and gain knowledge so that way you can advance yourself. But, you know, like I got a part-time job at GameStop making minimum wage. But what did I do with that money on top of everything else I was doing? I saved it. So that's earned income. I had to go ahead and trade my time and labor for a little bit of money. But when I'm saving that money, I'm investing that money, you know, accumulates. And at that point, I felt more comfortable with that than investing in something like crypto, not knowing much about it, hoping that it will make me money, even though I'm seeing everything go downwards. And I think for a lot of people that don't want to go ahead and jump into that, and they're a lot more, they're a lot more bearish than I am when it comes to things. I'm not much of a bull investor. You know, that earned income, that passive income strategy is still incredibly important. When I've been in times of extreme financial hardship this past year, primarily, I was actually able to depend on a lot of my book royalties for my book. Now, sure, a lot of money for me is not a lot of money for a lot of people, but for how much I spend and for what I really need, it was a good enough to be able to say, yeah, I could work this part-time job, which could not support a real person that has needs and has to pay a lot of rent and everything else, but it's able to cover enough to keep me going so that I'm not feeling the pinch from leaving my higher paying job. And I mean, I really do feel for millennials specifically, especially a lot of the people they graduate from college with, because I mean, the total student debt that we have in this country is way more. I don't know the specific number, but it's higher than that of the GDP of Canada. And when you look at millennials, people say that they're lazy, but millennials are actually more likely to work more than 40 hours a week willingly for less money than their parents' generation would, and they're more likely to work 2-3 extra jobs if need be compared to their parents' generation that had multiple recessions, the one during the Reagan administration, around the time of George H.W. Bush, to when it happened around 9/11, to again when it happened of that subprime mortgage crisis in 2008. So here you have these millennials that are just completely scared by the world because they keep hearing their parents and everything deal with this stuff, and then they don't know how to spend money. That they're financially illiterate. Like, no one taught me how to do taxes in school. No one taught me how to balance a checkbook in school. I'm really worried that, you know, a lot of students that are in high school, for example, when a lot of them can take a basic macroeconomics class, they know less about how economics actually works than when they previously went in. And that's what, you know, worries me at the end of the day. Not the scams, not the people that are jumping on stupid things. It's just basic financial literacy.
There was a – it reminds me there was a skit that I really liked that was on Saturday Night Live. I think he was kind of in that late 90s.
Oh, was
it
this when they were funny?
Yeah, exactly, when they were funny. I think it was the late 90s, early 2000s is when Will Ferrell was still on SNL. They had Chris Parnell and Rachel Dratch and that cast. And they had a little bit that was kind of like an infomercial type thing where the husband and wife, who was Will Ferrell and one of the ladies, were sitting at the table and they're like going over their credit card debt, right? And so they've got all their bills on the table and they're scratching their heads saying, gosh, I just don't know how we're going to dig out of this. And Chris Parnell, who is like the salesperson, he walks on up to the table and he says, are you having trouble managing your debt? Here, just buy my, you know, my whatever 17 page book. It's called Don't Buy Stuff You Can't Afford. and so the whole bit is it's really easy. It's actually just one phrase. It's just don't buy stuff you can't afford. And Will Ferrell says, so what you're saying is that if there's something I want to buy and I can't pay for it, should I go ahead and pick it up? And Chris Parnell just goes, no. And he says, okay, same scenario, but I have the money. What about now? And he says, okay, probably. And then it goes to the woman, okay, similar situation, but remove the money. Can I go ahead and get one today? And he says, okay, no. But it's funny and it makes the crowd laugh. But the point being is that it's a really simple joke, but it hits home for a lot of people, right?
Oh, like, absolutely. How many people do you know that have like 3 to 4 credit cards?
Exactly. So the audience is laughing, but they're laughing knowing that statistically, like 2/3 of that audience have a couple of maxed out credit cards.
You're being generous in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Being generous that they're paying minimum payments on and they'll be paying on it for like 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a perfect example. And I mean, I think Dave Ramsey is one of my favorite guys because he speaks at everything at a fourth grade level. But, you know, for people that really pay attention to Dave Ramsey, I wouldn't necessarily call him a financial expert as much as I would call him a behavioral expert. Because if you look at a lot of Dave Ramsey's, you know, investment and saving strategies, it's less investment advice. It's more behavioral attitude adjustment. Like I told – I was, you know, right before my seasonal gig at, you know, GameStop, for example, ended recently, I told a woman that I was on the cash diet. And she said, oh, what's the cash diet? And I replied, it's where you take out all the cash you might need for all your expenses throughout the month and you don't go to the ATM or pull out a credit card. You've got everything here and you stay within that pile of cash. And she looked at me as if I were Moses coming out with the freaking Ten Commandments. and she was like, well, can I do that with a prepaid debit card? I'm like, yeah, if you don't reload the debit card and you stay within that amount, it doesn't matter because you have the money. And I swear I must have changed this woman's freaking life.
Well, it's funny. I'm going to get myself into trouble right here real quick. But I mean, it wouldn't be a good episode if we didn't have a little trouble.
Oh, bring me some scandal, buddy.
So I'm going to tell on my girlfriend here real quick. Anna Kay.
Shit.
Yeah, I know. So she gets on my case because I don't have a savings account. I just – so for my cash, I just have a checking account. That's it.
What?
And she says, you should have a savings account so that way each week or each month you can have your money in your checking and then you can put a little bit in the savings each month or whatever that you don't touch. And I tell her that, well, I don't do that, but – If you do that, that's great. Like if that works for you, that's good. Because I know in her mind, she's thinking, I put my money in the savings. I don't spend my savings. I spend my checking, of course, unless my checking hits zero and then I pull it out of my savings. But that's then I'll really piss her off. But the point being is that it's impulse control, right? Like a lot of people, you can't have a conversation about are we in a bubble? When's the next recession? How should I deal with credit card debt? Should I spend $500 on Bitcoin? You can't have that conversation if you're still at level one of I want a new guitar or, you know, I'm ready for a new car. So I'm going to trade in this one that I still have a couple of years worth of payments on and spend an extra. I'm going to add $100 to my monthly payment and get a new car because I'm tired of this one. If you're at that level of impulse control issues and you can't hold on to just your basic checking account, then all of the rest of this is moot.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the crazy thing. We're financially illiterate and we spend money that we don't have. And then we wonder why we get into the situations that we're in. And I think both, regardless as to whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I've lived in blue states and I've lived in red states. I've met very rich people and I've met very poor people. And the only people I know that were prepared were the people that diversified their investments and the people that had passive income. People, you know, like Amway, for example, and this is not a plug for Amway. I am not part of Amway, but and I'm not going to go into why I don't like Amway, but like Amway is an example of residual income. That is something that a lot of people do. And when the situation comes where, you know, there are shortages of food and everything else, and people are wondering why all the prices for everything else is going up, why would you give Walmart more money in a recession when you can go to, let's say, Remso Mart if I had Amway? And that way you and I are supporting each other in that situation. Sure. And that's like me in real estate. Would I advise other people to get in real estate? No, because one, you either don't want to do it, or two, you're not in the market where it's good for you. I am in a position where the timing was good, the resources were there, and the location is prime. I will be good once I start selling, because no matter where I go, I have that passive income, you know, capability coming from the leads I generate on homes I'm either selling or homes I'm introducing buyers to. And a lot of people think I'm good with this job. And this is where I kind of want to start to wrap up the show, but it's with these generational misconceptions. There was a story from, I think it was around the late 80s, early 90s, of this man who worked as a forklift operator for 15 years. And what him and his wife did was, his wife was actually making more money from him than him at the time. She was a computer programmer. They retired. They move out to Florida 10 years after that. She dies. And what he does is he moves back to Georgia, where they initially lived. He went back to the same company he was a forklift operator for. His job was still there, and they had him starting at the same pay rate at which he was working when he left. Yeah. That does not happen anymore. And no. I'm sorry, especially millennials, if you think right now that your 401k and your Social Security is going to help you when you reach age 65, and you're assuming that that age is not pushed down, because let me tell you, both Democrats and Republicans want to increase the age of Social Security where you can get that, because we're living longer and other reasons, mainly because they don't want to pay out that unfunded liability entitlement. But if you also think that your pension is going to help you, I'm sorry, but that's not a safe bet. I know a gentleman that was working at Toys R Us for 15 years. He started as a stocker, worked his way up to a manager. When Toys R Us went bankrupt in the United States, he lost his entire pension and all his benefits. And he was working for a minimum wage job for a 16-year-old girl at another store.
Yeah.
And that is sadly the story of potentially millions of Americans every day.
Yeah. Well, let me tell a quick story about myself, and then I'm going to end it with a really foreboding warning. So all the millennials will be really
let's climb up there so that way you could push us off. Go ahead.
Exactly. That's so I opened a business. I had a printing company that was called The Print Stop in Columbia, Tennessee, which is south of Nashville, and that was my first business. I opened it when I was about 22 years old, and I ran it for about 6 years, and then sold that and moved to Florida for a time, ended up moving back to Tennessee with different stints with a nonprofit in radio, and of course I have my own show now. And I can tell you absolutely without doubt that I don't regret having gone into business, especially not regret having gone into business that early. I learned a lot more and had a lot more success as an entrepreneur than I did looking for a job. Looking for a job didn't get me anywhere. And I look, not everyone is cut out to be an entrepreneur, and that's okay. Like, it's,
I just don't like having a boss sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was told by a friend who was a business owner in town that once you work for yourself, you'll never want to work for anyone else ever again. And he was completely right. That is so true. Once you've taken matters into your own hands, if you've tasted even a little bit of success, you'll never want to work for anyone else ever again. And so though not everyone is cut out for that, it's educational malpractice, it's societal malpractice that we have kind of poo-pooed the career trajectory of entrepreneur as opposed to, you know, the typical sort of public school MO of just indoctrinating some wage slaves to go out. I know that makes me sound a little bit like a commie, but it's true, right? Like, the, you know, if you're somebody who reads Brian Kaplan and you read about the signaling model and how education is really about helping students prove to employers, well, I'm good at taking commands and following through with orders. Not necessarily so good at thinking for myself or having lots of skills, but more that, you know, I can follow the dotted line, so to speak. But entrepreneurship is definitely where it's at. However, I will say with all of that, kind of the caveat is I did some – I wouldn't call it motivational speaking, but about once a year I would go to talk to the graduating seniors at my old high school in Columbia, and I did that for a number of years. And one of the things that I talked
back?
To – right?
You're red-pilling them and telling them that the system is against them and they let you back?
In a public school, no less.
Nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I said to, especially to the young men, because obviously I'm going to identify with where they are a little bit more closely because I was there once upon a time, but to all of them, the boys and the girls, that you can't just look at it in terms of investment and money and, oh, I'm going to make X amount of dollars per year or whatever with my chosen career when I graduate college. And, you know, everyone's got those plans. Not everyone, but a lot of people kind of have that general idea of, well, this is what I'm going to be when I'm 22, 25, 30, 35, 40. And as you get older, and I'm certainly not old, but I'm 33, so I'm old enough to realize that I screwed up my 20s. But
you see, it's better that you did that in your 20s and not like some people that are experiencing this in their mid to late 40s. And that's the terrifying thing right now.
So exactly. So that's exactly the point I was about to make, Rimzo, is you have to start looking at it from a perspective of, look, no one is sitting around who's 27 thinking, oh, my God, my life's almost over. Like, no one is. I hope you all live to be 100 years old. I really do. With that said, you have to start thinking in real terms of what your prime is, and you have to start thinking of what kind of life do I want to be leading when I'm 50, 60, 70 years old. I grew up, my dad was in construction. He was a guy that was laying sewer pipe. I mean, he was working construction all the way into his late 60s, pushing 70 years old. And I saw that, and I would never want that for anyone. I certainly don't want to be 70 years old laying sewer pipe. I wouldn't wish that on anyone else. I would want them to be living a life of greater comfort, period, never having to do that job. I hope you go open the next Apple or Mac computers, but I definitely don't want you to have to be doing that with your 70. But the point being is that we all make mistakes, and we're gonna make some poor investments. We're gonna make some poor career decisions. Maybe we open businesses that don't work, and you have to try again. But at some point, you have to have the real conversation with yourself or within your life partner or whoever, that you have so many years on this earth that you're gonna have the strength and the energy and the can-do attitude to make your fortune, to provide for your family, to do those types of real-life things. And as you just put perfectly, you know, you don't want to be having this come-to-Jesus meeting with yourself. You don't want to be taking the Dave Ramsey course talking about how to not use your credit cards when you're 51. That's what you do not want to have, because then you're starting to think, oh, my God, I have a decade or two to – put my life in order. Otherwise, I'm going to go be on Medicaid and the government's going to own my house. You don't want that, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. Man, we definitely covered so much in this episode, and I'd love
so
to have
optimistic.
You. Oh yeah, like, you know, you're gonna have a lot of people that are gonna have nightmares throughout the night, but hopefully somebody will have, you know, really, you know, they were a bit encouraged by our conversation that you can get better, you can survive, and when bad times happen, you can get through the other side relatively okay, if not thrive. But hey, we got to have you back on the show more often to discuss a lot of the craziness going on. But for now, if anyone wants to catch up with everything you're doing, follow your show and all that jazz, how can they do so? Where can they reach out?
I'll give them my regular spiel. It's facebook.com/TGS Alan Mosley, and my Twitter is @AlanMMosley. But you really don't have to do any of that because you could just go to our website, which is thegoldstandardpodcast.com.
Outstanding. Perfect enough there. Anyway, sir, thank you so much for coming on. We'll have to get you back on the show in the near future.
I appreciate it, Remso. Thank you.
All right, folks. So you heard it from the man himself. We're not experts, but what you can do is you can become an expert in your own life. Look at what's around you, have an understanding of your environment, your goals, and understand that you can go on the path to recovery immediately. And you're probably hearing this and you're probably thinking, this is where he's going to sell me a product or something. Absolutely. If you want to understand how to make residual income, passive income, if you want to, you know, expand your brand, your name recognition, go ahead and set up a consultation with me at championpunditacademy.com. I offer ongoing self-development courses on Patreon for just $5 a month. You get access to the current archive. I'll be adding new courses as the time goes by when I have the opportunity to finish them up and throw them up on there. But if you want to have a one-on-one session with me, whether you're self-publishing or starting a podcast or something else, and you want to understand how to generate these passive income opportunities, go ahead and contact me today at championpunditacademy.com. As always, folks, tune in next time. I promise we'll get Alan on the show again. Learned a lot from him. I just enjoy listening to the knowledge that we can glean from him, and hopefully we can get better together. Take care, everyone. Good night.